1929, after averaging only $4.6 billion during the boom of World War I. Only later, in the midst of the Depression, did economist Joseph S. Davis observe that, in retrospect, in the light of revised data and a truer perspective, the mid to late 1920s should properly be regarded as moderately prosperous and relatively normal for agriculture. Much anxiety came from the so-called parity formula developed by the U.S. Department of Agriculture and pushed by a pair of farm industrialists, George N. Peek and Hugh S. Johnson of Moline, Illinois. They sought to maintain a relationship between the prices of farm and non-farm goods. The idea was deeply flawed in that no fixed relationships exist between any goods or services, but rather are always subject to laws of supply and demand. Worse, not only did the USDA's parity formula understate farm income, it also failed to take into account the revolution in mechanical motorized farm equipment, which essentially combined the genius of Henry Ford, John Deere, and Cyrus McCormick. That equipment tended to increase production as farmers plowed far more land, which was good, but depressed prices, which was a continued source of concern. American farmers could overcome price declines with higher overall sales, but that required open markets. And increasingly, the Europeans had erected tariff barriers to imported goods that limited American agriculture's foreign sales. The drop in agricultural prices gave the impression that farms in general were in trouble, when that was not true. But added to the price decline came several natural shocks that destroyed the livestock and farm economies of several specific regions. Wyoming experienced such a terrible winter in the mid-1920s that bank books literally froze in their cabinets and livestock herds were decimated. As the collateral for livestock loans disappeared, banks in agricultural sectors started to struggle, with many of them closing. A similar set of natural weather and insect phenomena struck the Deep South, destroying huge swaths of rice and cotton farms. Coolidge resisted McNary-Hauganism, a movement named for the sponsors of several bills, Senator Charles L. McNary of Oregon and Representative Gilbert N. Haugen of Iowa, to have the government purchase surplus agricultural production to maintain the parity prices. He vetoed two such bills, arguing that they would encourage one-crop farming, and he made the vetoes stick. Pockets where farming was collapsing, especially in the Midwest, certainly weakened the banking system by saddling banks with a mountain of bad debt. Bank distress then contributed to the second problem that developed in the 1920s, namely the slow growth of the money supply. Although no nationally known banks failed before 1930, state banks in the West and South had failed in droves in the decade. Many of those institutions had small, even minuscule capital, and they passed away without notice. But just as banks create money through fractional reserve banking when people make deposits, the banking system destroys money when banks fail. The Federal Reserve should have deliberately offset those failures and the contraction of the money supply caused by them by reducing the interest rate it charged member banks and making it easier for banks to borrow money. Yet it did not. Quite the opposite. The Fed had not even been keeping up with the growth indicators of industry, regardless of the drain posed by the agricultural sector. The nation's money supply, contrary to the claims of many economists and historians, simply failed to keep up with output. One reason even conservative historians like Paul Johnson and mainstream textbook writers have failed to discern this fact is that, once again, they have become obsessed with stock prices. This even led the conservative writer Paul Johnson to claim that the market was pure speculation, calculated on the assumption that capital gains would continue to be made indefinitely. Many authors cite the price of RCA stock, which went from $85 to $420 a share in 1928, with Johnson noting that RCA had not paid a dividend. But Carnegie Steel had never paid a dividend either when its value had soared 50 years earlier. Radio sales had expanded far faster than stock prices rose, and an argument could be made that RCA stock was still undervalued even after its spectacular rise. At any rate, securities provided only one snapshot of the economy, whereas the money supply touched everyone from the dock worker to the dentist, and from the typist to the tycoon. As the availability of loans shrank, business had less cash with which to continue to grow. That was seen in a third factor, the slowing of the manufacturing sector in mid-1928. Contrary to demand-side economists like John Kenneth Galbraith and the renowned John Maynard Keynes, demand did not disappear in the late 1920s, and wages remained high enough to purchase most of the vast number of new conveniences or entertainments. But firms could not add new production facilities without bank loans, which, instead of increasing, tightened when the Fed grew concerned about speculation. Members of the Fed's Board of Governors mistakenly thought banks were funneling depositors' money into the stock market and further dried up credit, instigating a shrinkage of the money supply that would not stop until 1932, when it had squeezed $1.03 out of the system. Evidence suggests that corporations sensed the tightening money supply and cut back in anticipation of further credit. Consumers had already begun to cut back. Other problems accelerated the decline. Why have historians been so wrong in their analysis of the causes of the crash and the Great Depression? Driven by political ends to blame the free market and capitalism, at the same time lionizing Franklin Roosevelt's statism, they have, by and large, portrayed the period as one of laissez-faire capitalism run wild. As intellectual Edmund Wilson said, "To the writers and artists of my generation who had grown up in the big business era and had always resented its barbarism, these subsequent depression years were not depressing but stimulating." They have completely ignored Hoover's big government responses, which were similar to those of Roosevelt in approach, downplayed the genuine economic growth of the decade, and pretended that Federal Reserve policy, a quasi-government agency, was inconsequential. And consider this additional factor, the Smoot-Hawley tariff. In analyzing the sudden nature of the crash, one has to account for a seemingly irrational panic that gripped millions of average stockholders. What would have caused millions of shares of stock, considered completely solid investments just weeks earlier, to be dumped so rapidly? One explanation is that the impending passage of the Smoot-Hawley tariff would not only change the export playing field, but would make imports more expensive, thus lowering economic activity on both ends. It is worth noting that the tariff did not result from special interest group pressure, but rather from congressional Republicans seeking to appease farmers, as had the Democrats for decades. This tariff increased rates already enacted under the Fordney-McCumber tariff by about 20% on average, but rates were increased much higher on some specific goods. Former Wall Street Journal writer Jude Wanniski raised the argument in 1978 with his book, The Way the World Works, that uncertainties over the effects of the tariff may have triggered the stock market sell-off. In our earlier editions, we subscribed to Wanniski's arguments, but subsequent research has led to a questioning of the direct influence of Smoot-Hawley. A new generation of scholars interested in trade revisited Wanniski's views, with Robert Archibald and David Feldman finding that the politics of the tariff generated significant business uncertainty, and that the uncertainty began in 1928, when manufacturing turned down and grew worse in late 1929. On the other hand, tariff specialist Douglas Irwin found it unlikely that the deliberations over the tariff were directly involved in the market crash. However, Irwin's observation that increases in tariff rates were lower than the 1922 Fordney-McCumber tariff ignored the different market conditions at the time. In 1922, the market was just taking off in an air of optimism. But by 1929, many observers were already concerned that the market was due for a correction and thus would be more sensitive to a dislocation. Perceptions of impending changes in policy are almost impossible to determine with precision. It is entirely possible that expectations that Smoot-Hawley would pass may have caused a massive, but certainly not irrecoverable, sell-off in October 1929. But it is more likely that declines in the overall market may have increased fears of a pending sell-off and that one small panic led to a greater one. Eugene White, for example, could not find any specific export-oriented industries that declined more than other average domestic companies. Concerns were heightened by new pending regulations in the utilities industry, the fastest rising sector of the stock market, and would have added a further shock. And after the crash, the worst fears of the Smoot-Hawley opponents came to pass as European nations enacted higher tariffs on American goods, forcing prices on those imports up further and reducing demand. If companies believed that the tariff would pass, and if they therefore expected hard times in 1930, it stands to reason that among other precautions they would take, firms would increase liquidity by selling off some of their own stock. Such sales alone could have sent dangerous signals to average investors, which then could have sparked the general panic. Were businesses right to expect problems associated with Smoot-Hawley? It becomes easier to discover the source of industry's unease from hindsight. Among other things recent research has shown, the tariff reduced imports by 4 to 8% in nominal terms, but when deflationary effects are factored in, and it seems that almost everyone in the country except the Federal Reserve understood that some degree of deflation had set in by late 1929, the real decline in trade attributable to Smoot-Hawley accounts for one quarter of the 40% decline in imports after 1930. But Federal Reserve policy cannot be overlooked, and monetary forces also played a significant role in the crash. Other research has shown that changes in both the falling money supply and trade had a ripple effect throughout the economy, and the tariff alone could have reduced the U.S. GNP by 2% in the 1930s, or an impact akin to that of Hurricane Katrina in 2005. Moreover, had such tariffs been introduced in any other time period, they could have brought about a recession all by themselves. Thus, we are left with some fairly obvious conclusions. 1. The Smoot-Hawley tariff had important disruptive effects. 2. Few people knew exactly what form those disruptive effects would take. And 3. The Fed made the harmful effects even worse through its policy of deflation. Aggregate demand fell dramatically after the crash, suggesting people knew the economy was in trouble and they began to hunker down. The only link that seems to remain for further research is how much the perceptions of impending chaos affected securities sales prior to the great crash. The combination of concerns about Smoot-Hawley, the need for a real but not necessarily large correction, and the rapid sell-off by speculators triggered a sharp decline. On Tuesday, October 29th, the market traded more than 16 million shares compared to a normal day's 3 million shares traded, and the indexes fell sharply. For the month of October alone, the New York Stock Exchange, NYSE, dropped almost 40% in value. A mythology unfolded in which brokers committed suicide by leaping from skyscrapers, leading humorist Will Rogers to quip that New York hotel clerks asked incoming guests, "You want a room for sleeping or for jumping?" In fact, few brokers' or bankers' suicides were ever reported. What is largely forgotten is that while the market lost about 33% of its gains since January 1929, the Dow stood well above where it had been prior to late 1928. In other words, the market had suffered a significant but not fatal correction. Enter Herbert Hoover, who now turned a bad but cyclical recession into the nation's worst depression and administered the coup de grace to the wounded body of American industry. Hoover accelerates the decline. Almost immediately upon assuming office, Hoover tried to prop up farm prices, creating another new federal agency with the Agriculture Marketing Act of 1929. Then he turned his attention to the tariff, where Congress had expanded the number of items in the tariff bill and had also substantially increased rates on many other items. Once the crash hit, the banking crisis followed. When the Bank of the United States in New York failed in 1930, followed by the collapse of Caldwell and Company in Nashville, the sense of panic spread. People pulled out their deposits, and the Fed proved unable or unwilling to break the runs. Indeed, contrary to one of the tenets of its charter, the Fed did not even rescue the Bank of the United States. Hoover did cut taxes, but on an across-the-board basis that made it appear he cared for average Americans, lowering the taxes of a family with an income of $4,000 by two-thirds. As a symbol, it may have been laudable, but in substance, it offered no incentives to the wealthy to invest in new plants to stimulate hiring. It was, again, a quintessential Keynesian response, addressing demand. For the first time since the war, the 1930 U.S. government ran a deficit, a fact that further destabilized markets. On the other side of the coin, however, Hoover taxed bank checks, which accelerated the decline in the availability of money by penalizing people for writing checks. Even after the initial panic subsided, the economic downturn continued. Smoot-Hawley made selling goods overseas more difficult than ever, and the public quickly went through the tiny tax cut, whereas a steep cut on the upper tier of taxpayers would have resulted in renewed investment and plant openings, thus more employment. Worse, Hoover never inspired confidence. When the Democrats won the off-term election, taking control of the House, it meant that any consistent policy, even if Hoover had had one, was doomed. As the unemployed and poverty-stricken lost their houses and cars, a string of appellations beginning with Hoover characterized all aspects of the economic collapse. Shanty towns erected on the outskirts of cities were Hoovervilles, and a broken-down car pulled by a team of horses was dubbed a Hoover wagon. The most significant response by the Hoover administration was the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, RFC, created in January 1932. Viewed by Hoover as a temporary measure, the RFC provided $2 billion in funds for financial institutions that were teetering on the brink. Although the RFC made loans, which for the time seemed massive, to private businesses, conditions of the loans actually generated instability in the firms the RFC sought to save. Federal regulations required publication of the names of businesses and banks receiving RFC loans. Banks which were in trouble because of the collapse in customer confidence anyway suffered a terrific blow by public notice that they needed RFC funds. This sent depositors scrambling to remove their money, weakening the banks even further. Despite a doubling of its funding, the RFC was a fatally unsound program. Having passed a demand-side tax cut in June 1932, Hoover then signed the largest peacetime tax increase in history. Whereas the earlier tax cut had proved ineffective because it had dribbled small reductions across too large a population, the tax hike took the form of a sales tax that threatened to further burden already struggling middle-class and lower-class families. A tax revolt ensued in the House, and when Hoover signed the bill, he further alienated middle America and produced one of the most vibrant tax rebellions since the early national period. Banks found their positions going from bad to desperate. As banks failed, they destroyed money, not only their depositors' accounts, but also whatever new loans those deposits would have supported. Without prompt federal action, which never came, between 1929 and 1932, the U.S. money supply fell by one-third. Had no other factors been at work, no Smoot-Hawley, no RFC, no government deficits, this alone would have pushed the economy over the edge. By 1933, the numbers produced by this comedy of errors were staggering. National unemployment rates reached 25%, but within some individual cities, the statistics seemed beyond comprehension. Cleveland reported that 50% of its labor force was unemployed. Toledo, 80%, and some states even averaged over 40%. Because of the dual-edged sword of declining revenues and increasing welfare demands, the burden on the cities pushed many municipalities to the brink. Schools in New York shut down, and teachers in Chicago were owed some $20 million. Private schools, in many cases, failed completely. One government study found that by 1933, some 1,500 colleges had gone belly up, and book sales plummeted. Chicago's library system did not purchase a single book in a year-long period. Hoover, wedded to the idea of balanced budgets, refused to pay military service bonuses to unemployed veterans of World War I. The bonuses were not due until 1945, but the so-called Bonus Army wanted the money early. When Hoover refused, the vets erected a shack city on the outskirts of Washington. The police shied away from a confrontation, but the U.S. Army, under General Douglas MacArthur, was called in to disperse the Bonus Army in July 1932. Naturally, MacArthur's actions were portrayed in the popular press as bloodthirsty and overzealous, but in fact, the protesters' claims had no basis in law, and their deliberate disruption and drain on the resources of an already depleted D.C. metropolitan area represented an attempt to foist off onto others their own desire for special privileges. In subsequent decades, Hoover would be assailed for his unwillingness to use the powers of government to halt the Depression. But the truth is that his activist policies deepened and prolonged the business downturn. Surprisingly, in subsequent decades, even Republicans came to buy the assertion that Hoover had stood for small government, when in fact he had more in common with Franklin Roosevelt than with Coolidge and Mellon. Hoover planned to run for re-election, casting a gloom over the Republicans. The Democrats realized that almost any candidate could defeat Hoover in 1932. It happened that they chose the governor of New York, a wealthy man of an elite and established American family with a familiar presidential name. In Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the Democrats did not merely nominate anybody, but had instead put forth a formidable candidate. FDR, as he came to be known, was the first U.S. president who had never been obligated to work for a living because of his inherited wealth. After an education at Harvard and Columbia Law School, he served in the New York Senate. Then, during World War I, he was the Assistant Secretary of the Navy, where he had served well in organizing the supply efforts for the Allies over the ocean. Franklin shared with his cousin Teddy the disadvantage of never having had to run or manage a business. He evinced a disdain for commerce. At best, he held an aloof attitude toward enterprise and instead developed a penchant for wielding public funds, whether with the Navy or as governor of New York. To that end, he had learned how to manipulate patronage better than any politician since Boss Tweed. But FDR also had distinctly admirable characteristics, not the least of which was his personal courage in overcoming polio, which at the time was a permanently crippling disease that frequently put victims in iron lungs to help them breathe. Yet Roosevelt never used his disability for political gain, and whenever possible, he kept the disease private after it struck him in 1921. Tutored privately as a child, he went on to attend Groton Prep School. There he absorbed the social gospel, a milkwater socialism combined with social universalism, which was the belief that it was unfair for anyone to be poor and that government's task was to eliminate this unfairness by siding with poorer over richer, worker over capitalist. How much of this he really absorbed remains a matter of debate. But in a 1912 speech, Roosevelt revived the themes of community over individual, emphasizing a new era of regulation. He proved less adept at managing his marriage to the plain Eleanor Roosevelt, carrying on with a social secretary, Lucy Mercer, as early as 1914. Alice Roosevelt Longworth, Eleanor's acerbic cousin, had actually encouraged the illicit sex, inviting the couple to her home for dinner without Eleanor, noting sympathetically that Franklin deserved a good time. He was married to Eleanor. By 1918, Eleanor had confirmed her suspicions, discovering letters from Lucy to Franklin in a suitcase, and she offered FDR a divorce. Family and political considerations led him to an arrangement with his wife, wherein he would terminate his meetings with Lucy and keep his hands off Eleanor as well. After a period of depression, FDR used his rehabilitation from polio to develop qualities he had never had before, including a sense of timing and patience to let political enemies hang themselves. Most of all, his rehabilitation had conferred on him a discipline that he never could have mastered otherwise, committing himself to details and studying public perceptions. Roosevelt's engaging personality overcame many of his deeper flaws. A failure as a lawyer, he lived off his mother's money and acquiesced to her financial control. He was feckless in setting policies that affected millions of people. One morning over breakfast, he randomly set the gold price, raising it by 21 cents. When the Treasury Secretary asked why he chose that amount, Roosevelt replied that 21 was a lucky number. Unlike Bill Clinton more than half a century later, FDR got away with dalliances with a number of women. Marguerite, Missy LaHand, Princess Martha of Norway, Margaret Daisy Suckley, and Dorothy Schiff, plus, of course, Lucy. More remarkable was the fact that he could no longer walk during the time he maintained all these liaisons. Best known in the context of his fireside chats as president, Roosevelt successfully used radio, beginning with the 1928 nominating speech for Al Smith, which, in a manner, he admitted, he directed specifically to the radio audience. One of his most important speeches, during his first run for the presidency, came on the Lucky Strike Hour, sponsored by the American Tobacco Company. But it was the fireside chats that allowed Roosevelt to connect with large numbers of Americans. He deliberately slowed his speech to about 120 words per minute, well below that of the 170 words per minute at which most radio orators spoke. Despite an elite Northeastern accent, Roosevelt came across as an ordinary American. One summer night in Washington, he asked on air, "Where's that glass of water?" And after a brief pause in which he poured and drank the water, said, "My friends, it's very hot here in Washington tonight." Realizing that familiarity breeds contempt, however, FDR carefully spaced his talks in order to avoid losing their effectiveness, aiming for a schedule of one every 5 or 6 weeks. FDR's adroit manipulation of the media became all the more important when combined with his pliable approach to the truth. The Depression, he claimed, stemmed from the lure of profit, and he decried the unscrupulous money changers, warmed over populist rhetoric that always played well in tough economic times. He knew, certainly, or at least his advisors must have told him, that it was an arm of government, the Fed, which had tightened money, making the Depression worse. One hardly thinks Roosevelt had the Fed in mind when he spoke of unscrupulous money changers. Once he won the nomination, he had an opportunity to solidify the markets and restore at least some confidence in the economy by stating the truth, that many of his policies would simply continue Hoover's. But he would not. Between November and the inauguration, Roosevelt kept silent when a few endorsements of Hoover's policies might have made the difference between continued misery and a recovery. These deceptions illustrated Roosevelt's continued facility with lying. Nor was he above pure hypocrisy. During the campaign, FDR, a man whose presidency would feature by far the largest expansion of the federal government ever, called for a balanced budget and accused Hoover of heading the greatest spending administration in all our history, which has piled bureau on bureau, commission on commission. Honest observers can find little difference between his programs and Hoover's. His own advisors admitted as much. Rexford Tugwell, for example, noted, "We didn't admit it at the time, but practically the whole New Deal was extrapolated from programs that Hoover started." Chapter 16, Enlarging the Public Sector, 1932-40. Economic Chaos. In addition to all his natural advantages, the flashy smile, personal courage, and his family money and name, Franklin Roosevelt also had good old-fashioned luck. After narrowly escaping an assassination attempt in Miami, Roosevelt took the controls of the U.S. government just as repeal of prohibition had cleared Congress, leading to the slogan, "Beer by Easter." If nothing else, the free flow of alcohol seemed to liven the spirits of the nation. It also filled the federal coffers, providing new sources of revenue that the Roosevelt administration desperately needed. When voters went to the polls in November 1932, they handed Roosevelt a landslide victory, giving him the entire West and South. Roosevelt received 22.8 million votes to Hoover's 15.7 million, a remarkably strong showing for the loser, considering the circumstances of the Depression. Roosevelt heaped dishonor on the defeated Hoover, denying him even a Secret Service guard out of town. Congress paid a price as well, having done nothing during the lame duck session because many members knew the new president would purposely torpedo any actions they took. In fact, Roosevelt hoped to capitalize on the terrifying collapse of the economy, his own absence of pre-election promises, and a timid Congress to bulldoze through a set of policies that fundamentally rearranged the business and welfare foundations of American life. Many of FDR's programs, undertaken under the rubric of a New Deal for Americans, came as spur-of-the-moment reactions to the latest crisis. The absence of internal consistency has thus produced confusion over whether there was a single New Deal or two distinct programs that were dramatically different. Timeline: 1932, Roosevelt elected. Japanese aggression in China. 1933, the 100 days, New Deal legislation passed. Bank holiday. Prohibition repealed. FDR takes nation off gold standard. National Industrial Recovery Act. Adolf Hitler named Chancellor in Germany. 1934, Securities and Exchange Commission established. Temporary minimum wage law passed. 1935, Glass-Steagall Act, Wagner Act, Works Progress Administration, Social Security Program created, Neutrality Act passed. 1936, Roosevelt re-elected. 1937, Rape of Nanking by Japanese troops, U.S. gunboat Panay sunk. 1938, German expansion in Czechoslovakia, U.S. unemployment soars again. 1939, golden year for American cinema, Hitler invades Poland starting World War II. 1940, Roosevelt re-elected. 1941, Lend-Lease Act passed, Japanese bomb Pearl Harbor, United States declares war on Axis powers. Were there two New Deals? Just as a fable developed about business failures causing the stock market collapse and the subsequent recession, a similar tale arose about Roosevelt's New Deal program to rescue America. Although most scholars have maintained that there were two New Deals, not one, they differ on the direction and extent of the changes between the first and second. According to one tradition, Roosevelt came into office with a dramatically different plan from Hoover's do-nothingism, and the president set out to restore health to the American economy by saving capitalism. However, although the first phase of FDR's master plan, roughly between 1933 and 1935, consisted of adopting a widespread series of measures at the national level that emphasized relief, around 1936 he shifted the legislation toward reform. Another variant of this theory saw the early measures as designed to keep capitalism afloat, especially the banking legislation, with a deliberate attempt to introduce planning into the economy. Rexford Tugwell subscribed to this interpretation, complaining that conservative elements stifled attempts to centralize control over the economy in the federal government's hands. At the point where FDR had found that more radical redistributions of wealth could not be attained, a second, more conservative New Deal evolved that emphasized piecemeal measures. Generally speaking, the Tugwell interpretation is endorsed by the left, which suggests that FDR saved capitalism from itself by entrenching a number of regulatory measures and social programs that kept the market economy from its own excesses. The fact that some historians identify two different New Deals reflects the utter lack of a blueprint or consistency to Roosevelt's programs. It served as a convenient cover for the fact that Roosevelt flitted from program to program without any overarching plan, aside from the presumption that government could and should do things that citizens previously had done themselves. Often, FDR's policies were haphazard, fluctuating with whichever advisors happened to be on the ascent at the time, championing a balanced budget one minute and unprecedented spending married to near-confiscatory taxes the next. More important, though, as historian Burton Folsom has shown, Roosevelt's economic policies were frequently designed with political impact in mind, releasing federal money here, withholding it there, so that at no time could one assume that any of the New Deal policies were solely or even predominantly directed at economic recovery. Then Nazi Germany invaded Poland, and many New Dealers realized that in a coming war, if it came, they needed capitalists. It is often said that the Second World War got us out of the Depression, which may technically be true, but not in the way many people think. However, it is undeniable that World War II saved Americans from the New Deal by unleashing the power of the private sector to make implements of war. The two New Deals interpretation has allowed scholars to deal simultaneously with the relative ineffectiveness of FDR's policies to extricate the nation from the Depression and to explain the contradictions of FDR's first half-dozen years in office. For example, he often claimed that he was committed to a balanced budget, Yet he ran what were and remain to the present in real terms all-time record deficits. Those deficits came in spite of the Revenue Act of 1935 that raised the tax rates on the upper classes from the already high level of 59% to 75%. More than anything, the two New Deal's view paralleled the ascendance and decline of different groups within the administration, revealing policy influences on Roosevelt from among a staff who spanned the ideological spectrum. At the advice of Raymond Moley, a Columbia University professor, Roosevelt sought to raid the nation's universities to produce a brain trust of intellectuals, then mix in a cross-section of business leaders or career politicians from around the country. Moley became FDR's trusted advisor and speechwriter, and he later served in the State Department. Roosevelt's administration also included Texan Jesse H. Jones, head of the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, two Columbia University professors, Rexford Tugwell, Assistant Secretary of Agriculture, and Adolph Burl, a member of the Brain Trust, Arizonian Lewis Douglas, Director of the Budget, Louis Brandeis, Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, and Harry Hopkins. Some, such as Budget Director Douglas, were budget balancers pure and simple. When Roosevelt took the nation off the gold standard, Douglas envisioned waves of inflation sweeping through the country, at which point someone suggested to him that they change the inscription on money from "In God We Trust" to "I Hope That My Redeemer Liveth." Tugwell was an intellectual and scholar who had written on economics. In 1939, summing up his views as the New Deal began, he exposed what he called the myths of laissez-faire, stating flatly, "The jig is up. There is no invisible hand. There never was." Others, such as Jones, who headed the RFC, a New Deal holdover from the Hoover years, were big government activists extolling the efficiencies of government-business partnerships. Still others, like Hugh Johnson, who ran the National Industrial Recovery Agency, NIRA, was an anti-business bully who threatened corporate leaders who resisted his voluntary programs with a sock right on the nose. Most of these policymakers subscribed in one way or another to the theories of English economist John Maynard Keynes, whose book, The General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money, had appeared in 1936. Long before Keynes had published The General Theory, however, his papers had circulated and his basic premises that government spending would spur demand and thus pull a nation out of a depression had thoroughly seasoned the thinking of the Brain Trust members. As Treasury Secretary Henry Morgenthau noted, a number of acolytes already labored within the government to ensure that federal spending was transformed from a temporary expedient to a permanent instrument of government. Traditionalists, including Morgenthau and Budget Director Douglas, instead argued for cutting government spending to encourage private investment. For weeks, the nature of the crisis had compressed the time available for considering the positions. The two camps fought over Roosevelt's soul, but the president sided with the Keynesians, and the race to spend federal money was on. Given these disparate influences on Roosevelt, it became possible for sympathetic writers at the time, and to historians subsequently, to portray FDR as either a conservative corporatist intent on saving the free enterprise system through regulation, or as a revolutionary who understood the limits of genuine reform. But there is another alternative. Namely, that the New Deal, or either of them if one prefers, had no overarching principles, no long-term vision, no guiding fundamentals, but was rather a reactive network of plans designed to get business. Many members of Roosevelt's New Deal Brain Trust could not identify any coherent precepts even years later, certainly nothing of majestic civic virtue or high moral cause. Quite the contrary, whatever clear policies could be identified, such as electric power policy, the administration's aims were crudely simple. One objective of New Deal power policy was to enlarge the publicly owned sector of the power industry as a means of diminishing private control over the necessities of life. It did not help that FDR had few business leaders among his advisors. He distrusted them. Roosevelt told Moley that he had talked to a great many businessmen, in fact, to more than any other president, and that they are generally stupid. Roosevelt cared nothing about the effects of the class warfare that he had started. When Moley questioned how the welfare of the country could be served by totally discrediting business to the people, he concluded that Roosevelt was thinking merely in terms of the political advantage to him in creating the impression through the country that he was being unjustly attacked by businessmen. FDR specifically looked for high spots in his speeches to get in a dig at his enemies. More than by the president's vindictiveness, Moley was impressed as never before by the utter lack of logic of the man, the scantiness of his precise knowledge of things that he was talking about, and by the immense and growing egotism that came from his office. At heart, the New Dealers were merely a continuation of Wilsonian progressives. They shared John Dewey's conviction that organized social intelligence could shape society, and some, like Adolph Burl, reflected the hope of the social gospel of creating a kingdom of God on earth. Roosevelt, however, had enough vision to know that the public would not share in his enthusiasm for many large-scale programs. Tugwell observed that the president engaged in secret amputation when it came to introducing programs that might generate opposition. If you have to do some social reorganizing, Tugwell noted, you do it as quietly as possible. You play down its implications. Mixing Hooverism with spot emergency measures applied to selective sectors of the economy, then combining them with stealth social engineering, the New Deal took on a variegated appearance, and perhaps the only thread that ran through it emanated from the Keynesian policy recommendations. Roosevelt had actually campaigned on a balanced budget, but like so many of his positions, that promise was campaign rhetoric. His choice of Douglas, a budding balancer par excellence, as budget director, seemed to reinforce that image. But the deficits told a different story, and between 1932 and 1939, the federal debt, the accumulated deficits, had leaped from $3 billion to $9 billion, and the national debt had soared to real levels unmatched until Barack Obama. Insiders with Roosevelt's ear, such as Tugwell, saw the only hope for escaping the Depression as lying with increasing purchasing power on the part of ordinary Americans, not with stimulating business investment. Thus, the New Deal contained little in the way of a guiding philosophy except that government should do something. Equally as important as the lack of direction, virtually all of the New Dealers shared, to one degree or another, a distrust of business and entrepreneurship that they thought had landed the nation in its current distressed condition. Above all, emergency measures needed to be done quickly before opposition could mount to many of these breathtaking challenges to the Constitution. The 100 Days. Although many historians characterize the New Deal programs as divided into categories of relief, reform, and recovery, such a neat compartmentalization of the programs clouds the fact that they were passed in haste, occasionally even frenzy, and that no one in 1933 knew that any of the programs would be effective or politically beneficial. Rather, the 100 Days especially addressed areas of the economy that seemed to be most distressed. The banking system had to be stabilized, and wages, including farm income, increased. And the only calculated policy Roosevelt had, namely to somehow restore the morale of the nation, rested almost entirely on intangibles such as public emotion and a willingness to believe change would occur. When FDR addressed the nation in his first inaugural, his comment that "the only thing we have to fear is fear itself" embodied the single most important element of Roosevelt's recovery program, a sense of confidence at the top. Bolstering optimism was no small task. Roosevelt excelled at projecting a reassurance to the public, and surprisingly to some, most Americans neither lost hope nor drifted into lethargy. Many of the groups hardest hit, the Okies and African Americans, remained hopeful and sanguine that despite the impediments, a better future lay ahead. By far, the bank collapse was the most serious threat to the nation. Some 5,500 banks had closed in a 3-year period, stimulated by the outflow of gold, which had undergirded the banking structure. Roosevelt immediately called Congress into special session and requested broad executive powers. Even before the session was convened, FDR announced on March 5, 1933, a national bank holiday in which all state and national banks would be closed and then examined. After the examiners found that the banks were solvent, they would be allowed to reopen. Banks that still might be in danger but which were fundamentally strong could reopen with government support. Weak banks would be closed. Congress, convening a few days later, approved the measures. The bank holiday obviously stopped the runs by closing the banks. In his first fireside chat radio address on March 12th, Roosevelt reassured the nation that the government had stepped in to protect the banks, and when banks began reopening on the 13th, deposits returned, leaving Raymond Moley to pontificate, "Capitalism was saved in 8 days." While not publicly tied to the bank holiday, Roosevelt's most important single act in saving the banking system occurred when he took the United States off the gold standard in April 1933, ending the requirement that all U.S. dollars be converted into gold upon request. Other countries not on the gold standard could convert dollars to gold, but the United States could not convert francs or pound sterling notes to gold. Foreign notes flowed in, then were converted to gold, which flowed out. That destabilized the banks in the most fundamental sense by kicking out from under them the gold reserve that propped them up. By protecting the gold reserves, FDR ended the drain and quietly and immediately restored viability to the financial structure. All along, the banking gold destabilization had been a response to government manipulation of market forces in which Europeans sought to gain an advantage by going off gold. If all nations had remained on gold, the market would have gradually reestablished stability, or if none remained on gold, the same result would have been achieved. America's bank destabilization occurred in part because only the United States continued to honor gold contracts, which was akin to being the only bank in town to remain open during a run, whereupon, sooner or later, it too would run out of money. This single positive action by FDR is widely overlooked. Over the 100 days, FDR unleashed a torrent of presidential initiatives focused mainly on raising wages or providing jobs. Congress turned out the legislation, creating what was referred to as the Alphabet Soup agencies because of the abbreviations of the host of new offices and acts. The Civilian Conservation Corps, CCC, and the Public Works Administration, PWA, both promised to put people, mostly young men, to work in government-paid make-work jobs. The CCC paid boys from the cities to work in the forests, planting trees, cutting fire breaks, and in general doing something that would justify the government paying them. 2 million jobs were created, and it made great press. As supporters said, Roosevelt sent boys into the forests to get us out of the woods. Two Roosevelt brain trusters, Harry Hopkins and Harold Ickes, battled for control of the piles of new public monies. Ickes, who headed the PWA, insisted that the jobs involve meaningful work and that they pay a wage that would allow the employees to purchase goods, stimulating consumption. The PWA, therefore, tended toward large-scale public works, such as new school buildings, hospitals, city halls, sewage plants, and courthouses. Many of these might have constituted worthwhile additions to the infrastructure under normal circumstances, and perhaps a few genuinely fell in the domain of the public sector. But the necessary trade-off of taxes for public works was missing. At the same time, schools were closing at a record pace because of the inability of local districts to pay teachers and buy books. And pouring money into courthouses and city halls rekindled memories of the Tweed Rings abuses. Indeed, had every dollar dumped into public facilities, for which there still existed no funding for the people to operate the facilities, remained in private hands, the private sector would have rebounded in a more healthy but far less flamboyant way. And grandiose these projects were. The PWA constructed the Lincoln Tunnel, the Triborough Bridge, and linked Florida's mainland with Key West. PWA money also paid for construction of the Navy's aircraft carriers Yorktown and Enterprise. Hopkins had headed the Temporary Emergency Relief Administration under then-Governor of New York, Franklin Roosevelt, and helped design the Works Progress Administration, WPA, when he became a New Deal functionary. In the 1970s, however, at least two different former Soviet KGB agents identified Hopkins as an agent of major significance and as the most important of all Soviet wartime agents in the United States. These claims about Hopkins, combined with documented Soviet infiltration of the Agricultural Adjustment Administration, leave little doubt that the model for American agriculture, at least in Hopkins's mind, was Soviet-style collectivism. On the surface, large-scale projects brought some measure of hope and demonstrated that the government was doing something, that America was building again, and no question the projects were impressive. Yet what could not be seen was that the capital for these projects came from the private sector, where it would have generated a similar amount of economic activity, but activity that was demanded by the market. But the job not seen is a vote not won, and therefore public activities had to be, well, public. Harry Hopkins's Works Progress Administration, WPA, which had come out of the Emergency Relief Appropriation Act, 1935, extended some of the initiatives of the Civil Works Administration begun a year earlier that had given jobs to some 4 million people. The WPA came about even as Roosevelt warned Congress that welfare was a narcotic, a subtle destroyer of the human spirit. Yet the WPA generated jobs of far more dubious value than the PWA. There is no question that the WPA, which critics label "we piddle around," produced benefits in the public sector. By 1940, the WPA could claim 500,000 miles of roads, 100,000 bridges and public buildings, 18,000 miles of storm drains and sewers, 200 airfields, and other worthwhile projects. It also generated a certain temporary measure of self-respect. Unemployed men could look their children in their faces as breadwinners. In an era in which most people took any work seriously and infused it with pride, even make-work programs had some virtue. But it also built opera houses when people didn't have enough money to go to a movie, hired writers to design travel guides when people could not afford cars, and paid for traveling circuses. Over the long haul, government's attempt to endow work with true market value proved as futile for Roosevelt's New Dealers as for Robert Owens's utopians in New Harmony or the Brook Farm Communalists. The inescapable conclusion was that if a task was valuable, someone in the private sector would have paid to have it done, or at least citizens would have imposed taxes on themselves to pay for it in the first place. If Roosevelt's new dealers thought that they could shift the tax burden for all these projects onto the wealthy, they were wrong. As always, the rich could hide much of their income from taxation. What the brain trusters did not take into account was the depressing drain on the overall economy by the disincentives to invest and make profits. Virtually all private investments stopped as industry felt punished. Another act designed to work in conjunction with employment measures, the National Industrial Recovery Act, NIRA, of 1933, was directed by the National Recovery Administration, NRA, under the hand of Hugh Johnson. A man given to a robust vocabulary of profanity, Johnson had been a lawyer and businessman as well as a soldier, and was capable of using his dynamic genius and exceptional energy to design and administer large-scale military-style operations such as the NRA. Symbolized by a blue eagle, a bright military badge to Johnson, the NRA authorized industrial and trade associations to establish production codes based on a blanket code, set prices and wages, and otherwise collude. The NIRA completely reversed the TR-Taft antitrust legislation suspending antitrust acts and recognized from the federal level the rights of employees to organize unions and bargain collectively, effectively cementing organized labor as a permanent voting bloc for the Democratic Party. It was unclear, however, how merely allowing corporations to become larger through non-market forces and to fix prices would restore vitality to the system. Eventually, the collusive effects of the NIRA sparked intense opposition, especially from small employers who referred to the Blue Eagle as a Soviet duck or a fascist pigeon. But in the meantime, it did what most New Deal programs did. It spent money on a large scale. The NRA became so corrupt that Johnson himself persuaded the Senate to name a committee to investigate, headed by the famous attorney Clarence Darrow. The committee's report, delivered in May 1934, called the NRA, among other things, ghastly, preposterous, savage, wolfish, monopolistic, and invasive. By 1934, the American Bar Association counted 485 pages of codes and 95 supplements approved by Roosevelt, another 242 signed by the Administrator for Industrial Recovery, and a whopping 10,000 pages of federal law created, compared to the total 2,735 pages of federal statute law existing before the 100 days. No incident better captured the astounding lengths to which the NIRA's codes reached than the Justice Department's case against a Brooklyn chicken butcher, Martin Schechter. He and his brothers, men of meager means who could not purchase protection from the government or bribe the appropriate officials, operated a kosher poultry market adhering to Jewish dietary laws. According to the NIRA strictures on the poultry industry, the Schechters could not engage in destructive price cutting, and the law prohibited the selection of individual birds for sale, only entire groups. Yet customers wanted to select their own birds, and a confrontation between a customer and a code inspector led to the indictment of the Schechters on federal code violations. Ultimately, a judge sentenced the Schechters to jail, a ruling that caused the New York Times to trumpet, "First felony cases won under NRA." However, when the case finally reached the U.S. Supreme Court in 1935, Schechter Poultry Corp. versus United States, the court ruled that extraordinary conditions do not create or enlarge constitutional power, and the NRA had abused the Schechters and other businesses through unconstitutional, coercive exercise of the lawmaking power. More astonishingly, after the ruling, Judge Louis Brandeis collared two of the New Deal attorneys advising on the case and read them the Riot Act. "This is the end of the business of centralization. It's come to an end," Brandeis instructed them to so inform Roosevelt. It was a small victory for liberty in a tidal wave of collectivism. Labor and Leviathan. By that time, however, the Democratic Party realized that it had struck gold in the votes of the labor unions, which it courted even more intensively after 1934, when the midterm elections gave the Democrats an even larger majority. The new House had 322 Democrats to only 103 Republicans and fewer than a dozen third and fourth party representatives. The Democrats held more than a two-thirds majority in the Senate as well. It was the closest a single party had come to dominating the government since the Southern Democrats had walked out during secession. Traditional Democratic supporters, such as the unions, saw their opportunity to seize power on a more or less permanent basis, and even the split of the unions in 1935, when John L. Lewis left the older, more established American Federation of Labor, did not damage the Democrats' support with organized labor. Lewis's new union, the Congress of Industrial Organizations, CIO, drew together industrial unions like the United Mine Workers, the Ladies' Garment Workers, and the Amalgamated Clothing Workers. In 1934, however, the unions overplayed their hand. A series of violent strikes, many of them initiated by radical elements, resulted in a wave of looting, burning, and general rioting in New York, Philadelphia, and Milwaukee. That was even before the textile workers began a strike of monstrous proportions, slamming shut factory gates in 20 states and setting off armed conflicts when police and troops battled strikers. Roosevelt conveniently was out of the country at the time, arriving home with his characteristic good fortune after the strike had ended. If anything, labor unrest only encouraged the more radical elements of the Democratic Party to press for more extreme demands within their new majority. Many viewed the period after the 1934 elections as a chance to entrench programs that only a decade earlier might have seemed unattainable, locking their party into power for the foreseeable future. Harry Hopkins sensed the critical timing, declaring desperately, "We've got to get everything we want, a works program, Social Security, wages and hours, everything, now or never." Securing the loyalty of the labor unions was crucial to establishing the Democrats permanently as the majority party. Thus, the new Congress passed the National Labor Relations Act, known for its author, Robert Wagner of New York, as the Wagner Act, which protected the right to organize unions and prohibited firing union activists. More important, perhaps, Congress established the National Labor Relations Board, NLRB, to bring management and labor together, at least in theory. In practical terms, however, management had to bargain in good faith, meaning that any time the NLRB decided management was not acting in good faith, it could impose sanctions. The Wagner Act thus threw the entire weight of government behind the unions, a 180-degree turn from the government's position in the late 1800s. Similar pro-labor legislation involved the Fair Labor Standards Act, which established a minimum wage. With the legislators' focus on raising the wages of employees, especially male family heads, little attention was directed at the natural business reaction, which was to trim workforces. More than any other single policy, the minimum wage law cemented unemployment levels that were nearly twice those of 1929, ensuring that many Americans who wanted jobs could not accept any wage offered by industry, but could only work for the approved government wage. After the law, in order to pay minimum wage to a workforce that had previously consisted of 10 employees, the employer now could only retain 8. The problem was that no set wage level creates wealth. It only reflects it. Employment recovery represented the industrial side of job relief, whereas raising income in the agricultural sector was the aim of the Agricultural Adjustment Administration, AAA, which sought to drive up prices by restricting farm output. Aimed at addressing the central problem of agriculture in the 1920s, overproduction, which had resulted in lower prices, the AAA subsidized farmers not to produce, that is, to restrict production. In one summer, southern farmers received funds to plow up 10 million acres of cotton, and Midwestern farmers were paid to eliminate 9 million pounds of pork, all at a time when unemployed, starving people stood in soup lines. Farm income indeed rose, but only because farmers took the government subsidies and kept their production levels up, occasionally double planting on the remaining acreage. Large corporate producers did well in the new system, receiving substantial government checks, with a large sugar company receiving more than $1 million not to produce sugar. But the farm programs worked in favor of the Democrats, adding to the Roosevelt coalition. Even after the Supreme Court declared the AAA unconstitutional, the administration shuffled the subsidies off to existing soil conservation programs, where in one form or another they remained until the 1990s, when Congress finally eliminated most of them. Still other parts of the 100 Days incorporated more direct state planning, such as the Tennessee Valley Authority, TVA, Act, which authorized public money for multipurpose dams to generate power for rural areas. The authority would build a 650-mile canal from Knoxville, Tennessee, to Paducah, Kentucky, and marked a further insinuation of government into private markets. Although most of the recovery efforts could be and were justified as necessary to pull the nation out of the Depression, it would be naive to ignore the political implications of the measures, especially for the Democratic Party. With each new government initiative, reliance on the federal government grew, and the party that would promise to maintain or even expand government assistance could count on the votes of large numbers of Americans who saw the opportunity to tax others for their own benefit. Such was the case with the Homeowners Loan Act of June 1933, in which the government guaranteed home loans. This legislation had the effect of benefiting new home buyers by making it less risky for a lender to extend credit, but it created a new quasi-dependent class of people who assumed it was the government's responsibility to guarantee that everyone could own a home. Supports of this type were expanded under similar Federal Housing Administration, FHA, and after World War II, Veterans Administration, VA, loans, all under the guise of making homeownership a right. All these acts carried the potentially fatal risk that at some point a majority of Americans would see the path to prosperity as running through the government, essentially taking from their neighbors to pad their own pockets. And at that point, the game would be up. All politics would disintegrate into a contest of